Hello and welcome back to the Advent IM podcast, Risk and Business. This is part two of an amazing conversation that I'm having with two absolutely fantastic people, Paul Minter and Karina Karan. Hi guys.
Hi Mike, it's really good to be back.
Yeah, hello Mike, hello Karina.
So you're in that type of field, the work where you're working in military, and then you're not really having time to think. Because you're drinking, which is depressing everything, you wake up, you've got to go straight into the routines. I'm just going off what people have told me what I see in the movies, guys. So if I'm well off, just let me know. And you go straight into the routine, and then probably the next, you know, depending how the day goes, again, it's a drinking. So it's heightened emotions, adrenaline, and then to calm that down, which works because it's a depressant, alcohol's a depressant, so it brings it back down. So you feel like you're okay. So when you then come out, if you think when you come out of all that responsibility and that camaraderie and you're not getting any support anymore and so forth, there's this kind of void, massive void, because it's like, what the hell do I do now? And there's people, individuals that are ex-military that I work with, have worked with, no one at the moment, and they come to me, it's like, I don't know what to do with my life. It's like, my lifestyle's different. I don't know how to communicate to my girlfriend anymore. It's just like, what's wrong with me? And it's like, there is nothing wrong with you. It's an adjustment period, you know, and that's what we can work on. So things don't feel so heightened. Because as soon as it feels heightened, normally they'd have a drink and it pushes it back down. So it makes sense. It completely makes sense how that depression could then turn into something even more sinister. You know, where it just starts going, getting worse and worse and worse.
It's so true. And I think it's important to say that, you know, in the military, things have changed a lot. I think the generations coming up, they're not as interested in drinking. And, you know, but then on the flip side, they seem to be a lot more isolated. So they'll be in their rooms, play computer games or watching movies on their own rather than having that social circle. So there's a bit of a, you know, pro and con on that side. And what we are seeing in the armed forces is there's a lot of young people taking their lives, which is surprising. And I'm talking like 18, 19, 20 year olds. They're normally around that age group. So not people who haven't been to war or haven't really experienced the real hardship of it, but they must be coming in through into the armed forces, coming from with a lot more mental health problems than what maybe we were used to before.
Yeah, it's interesting because when we initially caught up, I mentioned the fact that absolutely everyone that's been in the military or ex-military has come because they have had childhood trauma. We've got to remember, I say that within reason because my work is specifically based around that. So that's going to be my audience, right? That's going to be, sorry, my clients. So it makes sense with that. But then when you say that as well, it makes me think, okay, so it wasn't quite going so well at home, but then you know that if you are in the military, you're going to have that camaraderie, and that is so powerful for a young person, be it whatever gender. It's so powerful to know that you're going to be respected, there's going to be loyalty, people will die for you in a sense. So that's very powerful. But then there's a separation that happens. I'm not saying this is the cause, but I'm saying this could be contributing to the cause. There's a separation that happens from the way life was, even though it wasn't so great, but they're no longer around those people that they knew. So then there's a separation. So then if they are going on their computer games and they're more isolated off, then they're not specifically going to be able to deal with anything. It's just going to be in them and in their head, and that's it. And it gets to a point where it's going to, yeah, there's that shut off mode where it's just like, actually, I can't do this. This is too much.
It's really interesting you saying that, Paul, because we've been doing a lot of work alongside an organisation called Protect Ed, who do a lot of work in universities. And they were saying the same. There's a disproportionately high number of self-harming and death by suicide events compared to sort of even 10 years ago. So, you know, we have to ask ourselves, you know, what is happening to our young people that are the young adults of today? What has been happening to them that has caused this to be an issue? And again, you know, I mentioned the three fathers that have done a lot of, they've spent a lot of time on breakfast TV and, a lot of publicity, you're doing the walks and whatever. You know, all of them, their daughters were young and had their whole lives ahead of them.
I think a lot, I mean, I don't know. It's not a field I look into a lot, but I think it's just too much exposure from a young age, isn't there?
Mm.
Like for me, 6 years old, you know, if you're not being, if someone's not keeping an eye on you properly, you're being exposed to all sorts of stuff on the internet. You know, it's in your brain, it's in your mind. When I was young, I didn't know it. I loved being like a teenager because I had no care in the world. I didn't know of anything. All I knew was my friends and the football pitch up the road. That's all I cared about, you know. But now people know about politics, world politics. They know about wars going on everywhere. They know about all sorts of like crazy pornography, all sorts. So it's there's a lot more going on in young people's heads than I think when we were, or for a lot of people when we were younger.
Mm. Yeah, definitely.
But what I'd like to
say, go ahead.
Go on, Karina, go on.
I was going to say, just relating to that, if there is that shift of the younger generation not wanting to fall into having, you know, drinking alcohol, for example, what's the other way to ease pain? By harming yourself. Because you can do it and it's hidden, but you're not putting drugs or alcohol necessarily. I don't know what the statistics are around this. Drugs or alcohol in your body. So it seems cleaner. I'm not damaging myself. No one's going to know, but actually it's releasing some pain. Anyone that self-harms, it is to do with relieving pain. Yeah, to stop the pain or relieve pain in some way. But then, because I work with individuals whose children, so I don't work with the children, but they work with me because their children, one of the reasons the children are self-harming and they just literally at the end of the tether, they don't know what to do. But there's so much trauma involved. It's like, how else are they gonna, you know? So it's kind of finding different patterns that those children can do, those individual children can do, that takes them away from personal time, especially at night time, where they're more likely to self-harm. And also letting them know, which is so sad to have to say this, but the parents have to let them know about risks. Making sure if you're going to use a blade, it's not something that someone else has used. And it, just imagine having that conversation with, like, it's horrible, but it means that they're less likely to have something else happen to them. You know, there's children, young adults that are doing it together, self-harming together. And you just think, gosh, that's like, just make sure you're not sharing. Stuff.
And social media is an enabler of that as well, isn't there? You know, there are self-harming groups on social media, and you know, young people are almost being encouraged to do it at times by the stuff they're being exposed to. It's certainly a much more complicated and overloaded world than the one I grew up in, that's for sure.
Yeah, what I'd like to see is, Karina, you're saying, like, where else do they go? You know, now that they're not necessarily interested in that sort of drinking culture or whatever it may be. But what I want to see, and something that I'm a big advocate of trying to promote, not just in the armed forces, but in corporate businesses and organisations, is different groups and dealing with a lot of the things that we talk about. So I like to see groups where every day or every other day you go for 30 minutes, 45 minutes, and you're talking about sleep. You maybe have a meditation group, or you have this, or you got, you know, you're talking about maybe even an animal therapy or yoga or different sort of activity, doesn't matter what it might be, cold water therapy even. So they go away, so they've got these different things that they can go to, and they can, you know, it's a much more positive environment, so they don't, you know, still socialize and still around people, but they're not in that sort of drinking sort of culture.
Yeah, and keeping it in a way where there is funding still coming in. Just say if it was your charity, for example, there is funding coming in, so it's sustainable. So it's not just there for like a year, for as long as the funding works for, and then it drops off, and then where do they go then? Do you know what I mean? And then how do you leverage that so that as they get older, there's something else that they can then link into? Because depression is something that pops back up randomly. Doesn't take much for it to pop back up. If it's already there and it's not being processed, and what you can do within the realms of financial, what you financially can do, or given waiting lists on the NHS, is do this kind of stuff like you're mentioning, Paul, then it needs to be sustainable. It needs to be, it grows with them as well. And that's something that I'm kind of working, it's more with adults rather than children, because I feel like the adults within the local area, that's where the problem is stemming at the moment. But just creating something on Fridays where the NHS or the larger corporates can come to, and it takes them on a like deep state hypnosis kind of journey. So they feel so empowered and ready, and they start setting intentions for the weekend. And then at the end of that, they can go home rather than go into the pub and getting plastered, basically. So, you know, by changing that slightly, but yeah, I think with alcohol, it's really hard because what's actually needed globally is some kind of warning sign. This is a viewpoint on alcohol, just like cigarettes. I just feel like there should be some kind of warning sign. That's kind of like the root of many of the issues at the moment, where a lot of money is having to be injected into, but then it's a multi-billion whatever money-making industry. I can't even, there's probably a number I can't say on that. So yeah, I feel that's the problem. You know, the alcohol's the problem, one of the core problems that's feeding into all the other stuff, all the other things, whether it's trauma, CBDSD, veteran trauma, it just feeds into it.
I got on a slightly positive note, I saw something recently, and going on to like that, you talk about Fridays. So the group, it's mainly young men, but what they've done is a gym that opens up between 12 and 3 o'clock, and they get dressed up to an extent, but they're still in gym gear, and there's loud music, and they go in the gym, and they're all super hype, and they do it on Friday and Saturday nights. So it's like, rather than going out between 12 and 3, come to the gym, let's put some music on like we're going out, and they all high five, and they work out, and yet they walk home afterwards a bit more exhausted, but they feel good. They're like, I had my Friday, I had my Saturday, but I was working out. So I like that. It was a great concept.
You're talking about 12 midnight.
12 till 3 on a Friday and Saturday night. So
midnight.
Midnight till 3 o'clock in the morning.
Mine's like, I'll be snoring by then.
A rave in a gym.
That's kind of all it is. They have like strobe lights going off and everything. So this, you know, it's just a great way for them to go. I'm young. I don't want to miss out being out, but I don't have to go drinking. I can go and do this instead.
Yeah, and I think things like that, especially in deprived areas, would be so good. But then you still got that other side to it, where somehow people will still somehow bring something in. So it needs to be done, you know, it has to be done in a way that it really does work. And I think I've heard of that initiative, to be honest with you. I think it was a great idea. Strobe lighting at that time is not really my thing, but yeah.
it's for the younger generation, yeah.
I love it. But yeah, it's good because they're tapping into different audiences, and that's what's needed. And we do need to think of all the audiences across the span, including the elder generation, you know, as well. It's really important because a lot of the time they are missed off. And it's just like, why? They have to go into absolute crisis, like what we said right at the beginning of this podcast, for them to get some kind of support. And you're just like, they've kind of lived their life and contributed to the world so much already. Now it's time for us to support, you know, as a minimum, from my view.
I think that, you know, we probably talk about mental health and other issues like that more now than we did, say, 10 years ago. But I still think it's something that is largely unspoken. You know, it's only when you get people like yourselves coming forward and saying, I want to talk about this, or we have people going on to breakfast TV and start talking about their children having harmed themselves or you know, worse, that we get these sort of sporadic pockets of publicity about mental health, but then it seems to go away again, rather than being something that is continually talked about and openly talked about without shame or stigma or anything else.
Yeah, and I feel like there's so much value every time that happens. It's just so sad, humanly sad, that all these really sad stories have to happen to get the exposure, for us to showcase actually the impact of the work, like the charity or the collaborative work and direct work, Mike, that you and your team do as well. Showcasing that gives so much hope, you know, and it's the other side, not the other side, but it's part of the sad stories, but also for allowing people to have a voice, but in a different way. And I think that's so important. A lot of the audience that are having the complications with the mental health and so forth, there's a part of them that's not connecting to what's out there and being able to say to them, okay, this is an outcome that can be achieved. And it's so realistic. If you look at myself, all of us here, yeah, if we look at, we've all been through our own traumas in some way, that actually it's possible to be at this space and we can show you or guide you and navigate you and how to, and you, it's your choice. Yeah. There's different ways, there's different paths, but you can choose, but there's not just one road to get there. You don't have to only have therapy. You don't only, you know, have to do mindfulness. Actually, there's so many different ways of which we can reach you. Just give us that chance. And I think the exposure is really important, but also the type of exposure that's out there. Because I think the world loves sad stories. You know, we could have come on and just told our sad story. But actually, the angle we're taking is slightly different because we advocate in the way that we feel reaches our audiences as well, you know.
It's something that we're very open and honest about within Advent. And I get maybe in part, you know, because we do have a high ex-military contingent within our consultancy team. But also, you know, we talk openly and honestly about what's happening with our families, with our friends. It's something we've encouraged people to talk about. You know, we're very supportive of the military and the ex-military. And, you know, we've been a signatory to the military covenant. We're currently working towards the silver level. We have members of our teams who are reservists, and we support them and enable them as well. But wrapped around all of that, and something we became probably even more conscious of with COVID and lockdowns, was the need to make sure that everybody had the support and had the route to come and talk. You know, we set up virtual coffee mornings for the teams, not to talk work, but just to connect and talk and tell a story. We very quickly started an internal newsletter. So, you know, send us a picture, send us a story, tell us what you've been up to keep us all connected. And I think that, again, is possibly part of some of the challenges we have in today's modern world, is it's very easy to become isolated. Even in a crowd, people can feel alone.
Yeah, that's so true. And from the short interactions that I had with your teams, Mike, I can definitely say that rings true in the support. And it made me want to be closer to you guys, like, as a company, because of that. Because it's like, actually, the values are in the right place and people are seen as people. And there isn't judgment. As far as I could hear and see, there was no judgment. And people just relax and speaking. And, you know, the corporate world that I came from, I definitely did not feel comfortable speaking to my management at all. But I had to, because I have a disability as well. I kind of had to. I had no choice, which didn't make it that enjoyable, because it just felt like I was a bit of a burden, and it just felt like they're gonna not that they did this necessarily, but it felt like they're gonna try and get me out if I say something, because it's like, actually, there could be someone else that could step into my role that doesn't have these complications. So anytime I was asked, are you okay, I just said yeah. And it's like, sometimes I'd come off the camera just be in tears and absolutely depressed, but I'd say yeah. But what I'd done with that is I let my team know, at times I feel like this, and I don't want you going off camera and being extremely depressed on your own. I want you to talk to me. So I made sure with my own team, it didn't have the same way that I felt, you know. And I think, I mean, as we know, children can't survive without connection. They have to have that connection, yeah? If a child is born and there's no connection, they can't survive. And it's a built-in thing that we have from birth. We need to be connected. I know there's specific individuals that may not fall into that, but as a whole, in human life, we need connection to keep us going. Yeah. And the fact that you've done that, and I'm pretty sure, sorry, my buzzer's just gone off, pretty sure, Paul, there would have been stuff in the charity that done around that. I know I've done that with individuals when I started. Even though there was a quick shift into my business, I made sure I was available straight away, you know, and my old colleagues were still speaking with me, which I was really proud of them to do that, because they knew they could, until it got to a point where actually it wasn't okay to do that anymore because I'm not part of it, kind of thing. But yeah, I think positioning ourselves so people can connect to us is so vital. And if we're head of something, or we lead something, like the charity, like your business, like my business, it's important that the work that we're doing is congruent to how we are as an individual, and vice versa as well.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, ultimately, human beings, we're pack animals, aren't we? And and just friends of mine that I've spoken to who found themselves very quickly deteriorating in terms of their mental positivity during lockdowns just because of that isolation. And I think, we will probably see in years to come the effect that that will have had on the development of young children as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
My family are all teachers, all
Right.
the sisters, mother, partners, and they're just saying like it's crazy in schools, the mental health like side of things since COVID. It's just on another scale, like unmanageable. It's not something I ever see because I never associate me with children in any sort of way, really. So I don't have that.
I think that's for the best, personally.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I hear it all the time. But when you come from teachers who have been in that business for like 30 plus years, they're like, it's unmanageable. It's crazy. And that's come mainly from COVID. So yeah, it's really surprising.
And yet, what are we doing as a society to prepare ourselves for the potential tsunami of issues that we've created as a result of the last couple of years? And these children are potentially going to fall into a black hole, aren't they?
Yeah, so the hope is that there are enough individual like charities. I think it's the charities that are actually doing the bulk of the work, to be honest with you. That doesn't, diminish any other work that people are doing across the board. I'll just say that, call that out for a moment. But if I look at the charity that I work with specifically, and I hear the stories of the type of traumas that the children are going through because of, the outcomes of the adults that have gone through some kind of domestic abuse and so forth. So there's a story behind it. And then you look at the funding and you look at the wait list, and the wait list is around, say, just over 2 years, 2 to 3 years, and you think that child is going to be that many years older and is not going to get the support that they need, just like I didn't, but in their own way. Yeah. And you just think of the effect that's going to have. If we didn't have charities like them, like yourselves, for example, then there is that black hole. And that's why the work that charities do and organizations that are not non-profit, it's profound the work they do. And I think it's not always acknowledged. I know there's trauma wards and stuff, but it's not always acknowledged, the capacity and the amount of work that goes into it. And that's because people, individuals actually care. Really care about human life, and they don't mind doing something as a volunteer. They don't mind working with a charity with a lesser wage because the wage isn't what matters. Impacting that life is what matters. So I feel like, yes, children are going to slip into that black hole, just like I did, like our family did, like that happened. But I feel like now there's more things available to help kind of keep that child afloat for as long as possible. But then, when you think if they're not a child anymore and they're young adults, that becomes a bit of a danger. That becomes a bit more of a red flag because they're more influential. They're more likely to do something like drugs, alcohol, and so forth. So it's, yeah. And then you think about the justice system that they then fall into. It's quite a really unfair cycle for a child that has been innocently. There's been something that's happened that shouldn't have happened, and they've been completely innocent to it, and they fall into this life cycle that's completely unfair from my point of view for them.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, Karina. And as you say, these when it happens to children, that's not something that's within their control. But in the same way, and you, I suppose you could argue that we went into it willingly. But in the same way, when it's trauma that is workplace based, like it is in the military, to an extent, that is also happening without your control. It's a career that you've gone into, but I think, and certainly, Paul, you've been closer to it than I have, having been in the military more recently. But we've had an unprecedented amount of combat and conflict that the armed forces have been exposed to over the last 20 years than for generations before that.
Sorry, is that guided at me, Mike?
Yeah, Paul. Yeah, I just think we've we're saying about there's. There seems to be an increase in, children with mental health issues and adults with mental health issues. And I'm just thinking about the amount of combat and conflict that the armed forces have come into contact with in the last sort of 15 years, you know. I mean, you're seeing young lads now in the military with a whole chest of medals, which, you know, it seems disproportionate to their age sometimes.
One of the big things in the armed forces is there's those that have actually been and, you know, in the heart and the thick of everything, but you also get real big guilt complexes as well. So people who haven't been out there, or maybe they haven't done quite as much. I hear it all the time. I was trying to get someone to go and see a psychiatrist recently. He was in the army for 8 years, but he didn't go to any conflict. And he's clearly got trauma, like some deep trauma. It doesn't matter where it's coming from. And I was like, there's an armed forces charity I want you to go and speak to, some really good psychiatrists. And he was like, I can't. He said, how can I do that? I'm not even been on tour. I've not gone away. Mm-hmm. And I said, what doesn't stop you from having, you know, troubles and needing help? It doesn't, you know. So there's a real guilt complex. I've got a friend who's got two legs missing, where he got blown up, and he's got some fingers missing. A bit of his eyesight's gone. And he went, I feel bad going to get help sometimes because I see some people in there with three or four limbs missing. I'm like, you've got no legs. Like, why are you feeling bad about getting help? You know, have that, there's always someone else worse. And in a way, it's quite the British politeness, isn't it? Where we're also like, oh, no, you go first. No, you. Oh, sorry, all the time. They're always thinking about other people. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but we do need to try and say it doesn't matter what other people have done. It's right now, right here, I need a bit of help. I need a bit of guidance. You know, things are not going quite the way they should do in my life, so I need to go and get some help. And that's what charities and organisations are and should be out there for, to help people. From it doesn't matter what their background is, it doesn't matter what they've done and what they haven't done. If they need a bit of help and they need a bit of guidance, they should get it there and then.
And the other thing that I, you know, certainly I remember from my time in the military, if you didn't feel up to getting out of bed and facing the day, that wasn't an option, you know, because actually even to just get signed off for the day or a couple of days sick, you had to get up at 7 a.m. and go on sick parade and be seen by a doctor. And only then could you go back to your bed. And so even there, you know, we're putting processes in place that actually are almost forcing people to put on that game face, get on with it. You know, don't admit that you've got a problem. Just get on with it. I know, you know, when my brother was killed, he was 19, I was 21. He was killed in an accident in Germany serving in the army. And I was given 2 weeks leave, went home, funeral, went back to work. And the attitude was almost, right, that's it. You've been to the funeral. Now get on. Life is normal again. And there's almost this attitude of, you know, almost, you know, don't say anything. Because you might be perceived as weak, but also I'm not interested in hearing anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I can imagine, Mike, because I was in that for 18 years, and I know people went to the family members' funerals, and they come back and they'd be like, "Oh, you've had 2 weeks off. You've been on leave for 2 weeks." They're like, my mum's just died. Like, I haven't had 2 weeks off. What are you talking about? Yeah. And well, you've had 2 weeks off, so you can go and do this because it's harder, and give someone else a break. You know, so there's a bit of a lack of empathy in that sort of sense, isn't there?
Really is. Like, yeah.
You know, going to go sick. If you went sick, I mean, I don't think I ever went sick until I went to see a doctor at the end when I was for mental health reasons. I don't think I ever went sick in my whole time, because you'd be ridiculed. You know, people would say, doesn't matter what sort, unless you physically got a leg or arm broken, you will be like known as a sick person or blagging it or lying or whatever it may be. So you just suck it up, don't you? But, you know, but then once you leave the army, if you're not feeling very good, you know, there's no one there to stand by your bed. There's no one to charge you. I don't know if you know, Karina, when you're in the armed forces, if you're late or you do something that's out of what you should be doing, you can get charged. They'll charge you 60, 80, 110 pounds, whatever it may be, for being 2 minutes late to something, and they can do that. So, you know, you will make sure that you're there 5 minutes before all the time. But when you come into civilian street or the normal world, if you don't feel good, no one's going to charge you. There's no one, no one's getting, especially if you've got your own business or you're self-employed, that you're not feeling good. You can be in bed for days just feeling sorry for yourself without anyone saying anything to you.
Yes.
It is difficult. Mm. And that's where the pros and cons come, you know?
Yeah.
In fact, I can actually remember whoever sort of the duty orderly would come round the dorms, you know, the 8-man rooms, whatever. And I can still, to this day, I can remember the chant as sick, mental, dental, male. And, you know, anyone want to go sick? Anyone got mental issues? Anyone need to see the dentist? And has you got an email?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you one of the big problems that is there is in the armed forces and is, so mental health has been spoken about quite a lot more, not as much as it should do. And they keep saying there's no stigma, go and talk to someone if you've got a problem. First of all, they don't say who that person is you've got to go and see or go and speak to. And then when you do go, they say it won't affect your career, you just go and talk to someone. But and they kept saying that to me. And I was in a high power position and I had a very important job. And I remember them saying, just go and talk to the doctor. And I was like, if I go to the doctor, I won't be able to do these exercises that I've been planning. I won't be able to do that. Someone else is going to have to cover me. They were like, no, that won't happen. As soon as I said, I feel I've got mental health issues and problems going on, instantly they were like, right, you're going on these antidepressants. You're not allowed to be near any weapon system. You're not allowed to go near any ranges. So instantly I was taken out of, you know, pretty much taken out of work. I couldn't go anywhere. Everyone's like, where's Paul? What's going on? And they were like, well, there's only one thing. That if he's not allowed near a weapon, then he's obviously got, you know, got mental health issues. And then people weren't coming up to me and talking to me because they weren't, even they didn't know how to. So then I was isolated. I was in my room. Couldn't go anywhere. And then that led into anxiety. I didn't want to go outside and see anyone because I didn't want anyone talking to me about it. And then it led to me being in a room and just being very depressed and being like, how 2 days ago I was, you know, mentally wasn't very well, but at least I was in my office, I was working, I was doing this. And now all of a sudden I'm in bed, not moving, scared to get out and talk to people.
Yeah, your whole self-worth was pulled out from underneath you in one fell swoop, wasn't it?
That's it. And at the moment in time, I thought it was just me. I mean, now I know it's probably a vast majority of people coming, especially from the armed forces environment. But they just they get on with it and just, you know, bottle everything up and release it in different ways.
If you were to give our listeners, you know, one piece of advice, if you were to give them some, you know, an ounce of your wisdom and experience, what is it that you would like to say to them?
So, as you gathered from obviously our conversation, my speciality is more to do with specifically with childhood trauma. So if I'm going to speak more from that angle, first of all, you are valid, you are heard. And if you feel unheard, there are spaces you can reach out, and you can feel free to reach out to me at any time, not in the realms of a coaching perspective, but it's important that you're heard. It is possible to heal from childhood trauma and past trauma. It's completely possible to heal from it in a way that, yes, the trauma is always going to exist, but you can desensitize the impact and the emotional responses that you're currently having. That's something that I've done myself as a lived experience, and it's what I do with people that I work with as well. So when you are feeling that low and you feel like you're falling into a hole, know that there's someone there that will throw you a rope or that will send that ladder down to pull you back out. Make sure you do reach out to someone. Doesn't matter who it is. I created something, and I think I mentioned it once, Mike, with yourself, that I created something called a Purple Heart with people that I know. And the Purple Heart, if you send that as an emoji, it simply means I'm really not okay, but I also can't talk. And that means whoever receives it, you send it to absolutely everyone. You let them know what it is so they know when they receive it what it means. And anyone that receives it, you make sure that you do support that individual. And that could be a voice note because it means they're not feeling like speaking. You can send a voice note. You can send something silly. You can send a picture of you and them doing something silly. Or you can just send a song that you know that they like. There's different ways to reach out. So Purple Heart is something that's very powerful as well. But the what happened to you should not have happened, and that will always remain a fact. But you are not that person that you were then. Whoever done whatever to you no longer has any power. It just feels like they do. Feelings are not facts, which means they can be changed. You just need to know how, and that's where you reach out. So the core message is, it's possible to heal. You do not need to live in that state that you're feeling. If you are living in an uncomfortable state, you do not need to be in that state for the rest of your life. It's possible to pull out of that with some guidance and navigation.
Brilliant. Thank you, Karina. And Paul?
I would say to people, try your hardest to do a lot of self work. There's something seriously incredibly powerful when you take control of your day and your feelings and your emotions and the outcome of your day. I'm always about trying to tip the balance, my daily balance, to be more positive than negative. Even if it's just 51 to 49, you're on a winning level there. And there's so many small things, and I've spoke about them already, but so many small things, from like journaling, whether that be first thing in the morning, last thing at night, sleep, it's just so important. All these different things, ecotherapy is huge, just being outside, looking at stuff, I love being in awe of things. So when you're in awe, you start to open your mind up a lot more, and just like you look at the world. And already by being in awe of, you know, of nature, of the sea, or of trees, and or how people are grown, or the body, or whatever it may be, you start to be grateful for smaller things, the smaller details in life. But I know a lot of people, where people are listening to this, or people that I work with, they always say, I don't know where to start. Just come up with a subject, whatever it may be, what you might want to work in, and then go onto Google, go onto YouTube, and just start watching some videos, just start reading some books, listen to some podcasts. It makes such a big difference when you take control yourself.
Fantastic. Thank you, guys. I just want to finish by reading something out to our listeners. It was something that I read online on social media, which is an extract from a statement that somebody had made who had been in a bad place. I didn't want to wake up. I was having a much better time asleep. And that's really sad. It was almost like a reverse nightmare. Like when you wake up from a nightmare, you're so relieved. I woke up into a nightmare. I woke up into life. Life was the nightmare.
Yeah, deep.
And it just really, I read it and it really touched me, and I just wanted to bring it in to close off this podcast, because, you know, I think if anybody is in a situation where the worst possible outcome for you can be to wake up, you know, that's a very, very sad situation. And I'm so in awe of the work that both of you are doing. You're absolutely amazing people. I'm grateful to count you in my peer group and in my circle of friends. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today.
Thank you, Mike. Thanks, Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
We'll put contact details for both of you and your organisations up alongside the podcast. So if people want to reach out, need help, then they've got someone as a point of call. Thank you. Thank you very much for listening to the Advent IM podcast, Risk in Business. I've been Mike Gillespie, and I've been absolutely in awe of the knowledge and the compassion that these two people have brought to this podcast. Thank you, Paul, and thank you, Karina.